This show proudly sponsored by Real American Freestyle Wrestling. Real American Freestyle is the first ever unscripted pro wrestling league created by Hulk Hogan, Chad Bronstein, Israel Martinez, and Eric Bischoff to give elite wrestlers a real shot at professional career. Real American Freestyle is where Olympians, world champions, and NCAA legends come to compete. Not in a cage, not in a script, but on the mat in front of fans around the world. This is real wrestling, reimagined for today. The first event kicks off August 30th in Cleveland, featuring matchups with some of the best wrestlers on the planet. You've never seen wrestling like this. Learn more at realamericanfreestyle.com.
News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. So glad you're there. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show coming your way. It's an important one, too. We have Lieutenant Colonel Alan West come to us from Texas. We're going to talk about what's happened there. Really, in Texas, surprising. In the Houston area, there was some backlash against ICE. You wouldn't expect that there outside Austin, but in fact, it happened. And quick announcement of the Patriot Awards coming up 8 days, November 6th at 8 o'clock. So you can get it streaming on Fox Nation, but you can still get tickets to see be there yourself. Go to foxnation.com/Patriot Awards. You know, the president's overseas. There's a lot going on in Congress, even though it's shut down. So let's get new poll numbers in for the local elections, which is exactly 1 week away. So let's get to the big three.
Number three.
Everybody in this room knows exactly what's going on, and it's so infuriating to us. The best way for SNAP benefits to be paid on time is for the Democrats to end their shutdown, and that can happen right now if they would show some spine.
Shutdown day 27, and Dems try to spackle cracks in their base, including one of the nation's largest unions calling on them to sign the CR and get back to work, as Speaker Johnson seems ready to bring back the House.
Number two.
This guy is somebody who's got real chops, and that transcends what you stand for, right or left or somewhere in between. I think that's why he's poised to win, why he won so convincingly in the primary earlier this year.
I don't know what he means by chop. Chop usually means experience, but that's Jonathan Martin of MSNBC. Cuomo closes in on Mondami as Main Street Dems begin to fall at the 34-year-old communist feet, including Mayor Pete. As Jack Cittarelli picks up more Democratic support in New Jersey, could it give the Republican a win? Will it be a win for Jack in 7 days?
Number one.
It's a whirlwind presidency. He's taking on more major issues than any president I can ever remember. I mean, sometimes, you know, issues are thrust on presidents. He's come into office and taken on 4 major foreign policy initiatives.
Simultaneously in 9 months. And that's just not a guy talking. That's Britt Hume reflecting. Trump trip, a massive success. His attitude is everything. Energizing, cutting rare earth deals from Malaysia. Now with Japan. Inspiring addresses to troops, to the Navy about 4 hours ago. And straight ahead, a deal with China, they say, is all but done. Surprise summit with Kim Jong-un. Could that be next? Why not? The president the world was told not to accept 8 years ago is now the man they all want to impress. I don't know how it switched, but it's pretty amazing. I also think it's with his staff, too. Remember, General Kelly, who I really liked, but was not a good mix with President Trump. John Bolton, a terrible mix with President Trump. Rex Tillerson, a terrible mix with President Trump. And we know Comey lasted a very short time because he's was a terrible FBI director, but he lasted way too, probably never should have lasted through the transition. Most of the people there first were just Republicans and said, you know, I'll try to get him ready, do the best I can. Now the people around him are trying to work hard for him. It reminds me a lot of like sports when you have players just play hard for certain coaches and you go, what is it about that coach? Why do people play hard for you? And there's just something about the way they approach things. They want to impress him. And that's what I'm seeing in Malaysia, what I saw in Japan a few hours ago, and Trump just loving the feeling overseas. Now he pronounces a deal. There's good with feelings and there's good deals. Here's what Trump just announced. Cut four.
That's why we're leading China. We're leading everybody in this race. So we're with you all the way. And I hope everyone's going to do great and make a tremendous amount of money and create a lot of jobs under the historic trade deal with the prime minister that I signed today and private sector agreements that were signed moments ago. We'll be increasing our commerce very, very much further. Japan's going to be investing $550 billion into the United States, and It's an amazing thing, and they're happy, and they're gonna love it. It's gonna be really good. It's gonna be a great for everybody.
So far we're seeing these deals being cut, but the president's focus, like a laser, and his team, his energy secretary, and as well as Doug Burgum, interior secretary, on rare earth, the stuff that we don't mine and refine. He wants it done elsewhere and doing deals, and we'll pay. Malaysia signs a mineral pact. Thailand signs a processing deal. We have $13 billion Australian rare earth processing deal all done. And because Australia has a deal with Cambodia for extraction rights, they can transfer that over to us for a certain price, and we're willing to pay. Now, Japan, which cut Chinese dependency 30%, now deployed across all American businesses. You heard $550 billion. It started at $350 billion. These are all the things that give the president leverage when he goes to China. Now, what's going to happen with China? I hear this is going to be a major deal. I hear they're going to agree immediately to buy soybeans and start buying agricultural products from our farmers immediately. I also hear that they're going to, for a year, not restrict rare earth deliveries to us for a year. By that time, I think we should be standing up with other deals. I hope we don't stop. Now, other things that we are doing, I think, is important, and that is getting China, in terms of letting China know that they will have TikTok. It'll be transferred to us. Now, I haven't seen the details of this, but I want the tech expert to sign off on it. I just got to make sure the algorithm and no tractability is back to China to find out what Americans think, what they do. Okay, you might be sitting there in Iowa or in Orlando and saying, I don't care if the Chinese know that, you know, I'm paying $1,200, $2,200 a month in my mortgage. I don't care if they know that I'm a little overdrawn in my checking account. Well, that's not what they want. They want to know trends and feelings. They want to know how to play the American public. They want to know how to pick the best politician that was going to be the nicest to China. And they want their issues to be the priorities of Americans. Now, they won't just say, do this. What they'll do it through a news feed, through making sure the algorithm gives you a certain look, whether it's poisoning the mind or shaping the mind. You're not going to see many, best example, you're not going to see many pro-Taiwan stories. Big story in the New York Times came out about an hour ago that China's pushing the Trump team on Taiwan to soften their support. They want Trump to say he does not support independence of Taiwan. Okay? Incremental move. The next president comes in and then they say, we don't care what happens to Taiwan. Now, the president has said, you know, why do they have so much of the chip manufacturing and why don't they spend more in defense? Viable, good questions. But the president's just got to be sure that we are not selling Taiwan down the river. It's a bad sign for all those other aggressive nations that we could go take a country if we want. And China says they never should have left. Bottom line is, almost everyone in China wants to be in Taiwan because it's free. It's a free, democratic region, territory, whatever you want to call it, country. And we have, for example, to please China, when the Taiwan's president came over, we told him not to stop in New York. There were no meetings with Trump officials. Also, they were supposed to do a meeting with Taiwan leaders to work out some type of deal, and they moved it from D.C., to Alaska. So that pleases China. And these are subtle, these cursory things. And if it could help the farmers, could help us through the rare earth situation now, which is really a crisis if we can't get it, I understand it. But I think that we've got to make it clear the president cannot soften his alliance with Taiwan. We have to make it clear we will defend Taiwan. And the one thing I back Joe Biden on, even though it trumped his staff that didn't want him to do it. Here's Trump on what he's doing with China and what he hopes to accomplish with China. He knows it's coming up on Thursday, and he knows it has very much to do with where they're heading as a country. And he thinks he's got a big announcement. I mean, the word is it's not going to be a framework signed on Thursday. It is going to be a comprehensive deal. And then after that, it is all about it's all about compliance. And I think we're willing to do that. A guy that's impressed by Trump and the way he's working with China is Governor Ron DeSantis. He was on last night on the network, Cut 12.
One of the things that you're seeing is strengthening ties with other Asian nations. You know, that helps to isolate China economically. It helps to strengthen the United States economically. And I think adds to the president and the administration's hand when it comes to brokering a deal with China. You know, we have a stronger economy than China, but Xi has a very high threshold for pain because he really doesn't care what happens to his citizens. It's all about whether the Communist Party remains in power. And as long as he has a grip on power, he's willing to do what suits him. But I think what you're seeing develop is a very strong coalition. And I think it helps bolster the United States in the region. I think it helps weaken China.
I think so, too. And we'll see. Evidently, the only thing that would stop a signing of a deal would be, believe it or not, they say President Xi has got to go back to his people, his staff, and get him to sign off on it. And there's some ministers there. I don't think that, I mean, to me, that doesn't sound true, but that's some of the report I'm getting from the White House, that he can't just unilaterally sign a deal. I thought it was us, the ones that had to go double and triple check. Now, the other big story is he shut down the government. It's really hurting people. It's certainly hurting air travel. I was talking to Secretary of Transportation Sean Duffy today. A lot of air traffic controllers, TSA agents, really stressed about not being able to pay their bills. The story he told us about one of the air traffic controllers' kids have made travel volleyball, had to tell the coach, I cannot afford to pay the fees. The kid can't go travel with the team. And there's not a lot, meaning 70% of the people live paycheck to paycheck. They show up for work every day, and now they're not getting paid. But yesterday, I think this could break the Democrats and just shows you how unnerving this is getting. One of the biggest unions and big support, Democratic supporting unions, AFGE, their president, Everett Kelly, put this out. When the folks who serve the country are standing in line for food banks after missing a second paycheck because of the shutdown, they aren't looking for partisan spin. They're looking for the wages they earned. The fact is they've been cheated out of it is a national disgrace. It's a long past time for our leaders to put aside the partisan politics and embrace the responsibility of government. A strong America requires a functional government, one that pays its bills, honors its commitments. The path for Congress is clear. Reopen the government immediately under the clean, continuing resolution. You know who said that? Every Republican, not named Rand Paul. Every Republican. That means deliver the 6 more Democratic votes, get back to work, and then you can negotiate. And the president said he would work with them if they negotiate. I mean, if they get back to work. The president's doing his thing. He's trying to do the world economy, do his tour. He's not going to stop simply because Chuck Schumer's trying to take a stance. But the hurt is real. Air traffic is going to suffer. And I think we're going to start seeing the SNAP program, which is really food stamps. That's going to be cut off. People got to eat. They're going to end up in shelters, in soup kitchens. That's going to strain that. So this is the biggest unnecessary stress that I can ever imagine. And I've been through so many shutdowns on this show. This seems to be the most ill-advised to date. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. So glad you're here. 1-866-408-7669. When we come back, I'm going to bring you inside the new polls that just came out. This shows Cuomo rapidly gaining on Zohran Mamdani. Don't move.
Want even more, Brian? Download the podcast at BrianKilmeadeShow.com. Every episode, exclusive interviews on demand. More of Kilmeade coming up.
Every day, America's first responders stand ready. Firefighters, law enforcement, paramedics, doctors, dispatchers, and people who put themselves on the line for public safety. But keeping them connected in moments of crisis has not been easy. That's why Congress authorized a nationwide network for public safety. Today, that promise is fulfilled through FirstNet. It's the only nationwide network built with and for first responders. So whether it's a big city, rural town, or remote tribal community, FirstNet helps ensure no call for help goes unanswered. It gives first responders priority access, never throttles their communications in the U.S., helping them to connect across agencies when it matters most. This isn't just a network. It's a lifeline, a bipartisan commitment to America's public safety, built to serve those who serve us all. FirstNet is the backbone of our nation's emergency response and will continue to be in the future. FirstNet, built with AT&T. Learn more on firstnet.com/public safety first.
If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Joe Biden announces he gets out of the race. Nancy Pelosi gets out in front and supports Kamala Harris, and you report that Barack Obama called her, basically asking, what the F did you just do?
Yeah, the two of them had been basically working to try to get Biden out of the race. And they had been adamant that when he gets out, we need to have some kind of a process, whether it be a mini flash primary, something, a meeting of delegates, something.
And don't just hand it over to Kamala.
Don't just hand it over to Kamala Harris. Right. And they had a pact on this. Yeah. And she gets out, and everybody endorses her within hours, you know. Shapiro, Whitmer, Gavin Newsom, that they're all endorsing her within hours. Pelosi actually waits till the next day, but she sees that there's nothing that, right. nothing to hold the tide. So she puts out the endorsement, gets this phone call. I actually spoke to somebody who overheard the phone call. And what Obama says is basically, what, Nancy, what was that all about? And clearly irritated. Now, I've spoken to people close to President Obama who say he was just kind of giving her, joshing with her and giving her a hard time. I've spoken to another person who, you know, very close to Pelosi, says, no, she was pissed off. She was angry. He was angry. The clear message was, why did you do that?
Yeah, by the way, that's Jonathan Carl's book. That's his account. I mean, it's the most ridiculous give and take because, number one, Kamala Harris sewed it up when Joe Biden endorsed her, number one. Number two is she picked up the phone, to her credit, and locked up all those delegates. So you could go and say, I'm going to go endorse somebody else. I'm Barack Obama. Fine. But you never really forced the hand of Joe Biden. It was Nancy Pelosi who picked up the phone, says, what do you mean you're winning? Joe, no, you're not being told the truth. Put your pollster on. He put him on. He's like, you're not telling him the truth. That was not Obama doing that. That was Nancy Pelosi. But now you have a situation where they're all pointing fingers at each other. And it's just a disaster. You have Kamala Harris out there trying to sell books, trying to say, I couldn't have won with 107 days if I needed more time. If she got more time, she never would have got the nomination. We already saw that. She's not the best candidate. She thinks she's going to run again. A disaster for Democrats, because she probably does have enough people to be a contender, unless someone's going to take her on. And they don't really have real primaries on the left. I'm pretty sure they're going to try to handpick them again. And then you got KJP comes out with her book that brings up more Biden stuff. And the Auto Pen report is out that shows that Joe Biden really wasn't doing anything, and said his doctor and his key aide are the ones who know how little he actually did, including signing legislation and signing pardons. But if you want to know the big difference between the right and left, I think that this statement, which is so similar to what he said for 4 years in the White House, Joe Biden yesterday, cut 47.
I can't sugarcoat any of this. These are dark days. But we're one of the only countries in the world that time and again has come out of every crisis we face stronger than we went into that crisis. Folks, it's time to get back up. It's time to get reengaged. It's time to act. To fight like hell.
So he said that every day. You know, it's a Donald Trump dark days and all that nonstop. And that's how we campaign. It's going to be dark days. Does he not know that most people don't agree with him? Now, a lot of the Democrats, people that voted for him, probably are like, well, not dark days. Most of them are like, I would have rather voted for somebody else. But you look at what Donald Trump's doing. Yeah, you might love all of it. But man, the competency is there. The policies are there. The implementation is there. The successes are there. The impactful moves are happening all around us. Just take a second, if you're capable at all, and tell me what you don't want. These are dark days. What's dark about him? Whether he was dancing in Malaysia, the speech on the aircraft carrier, the Palestinian peace deal that you couldn't land. You could say, Alaska didn't work out, and I would have done different in Ukraine. But I guess he's not capable of doing that. But if that is, isn't it amazing to me that most people I talk to, the absence of DEI, back to more of a meritocracy, building up our military, showing strength around the globe, playing a role diplomatically and militarily in so many hot spots, maybe rattling the cage of our enemies, whether it's Iran or Venezuela. People are relieved. I mean, 82% of Trump voters and 74% of Republicans are for putting pressure on Venezuela. That's exactly what he's doing, focusing on the Western Hemisphere. That's exactly what he's doing. Is it amazing to you to think, all these things that have changed for the positive, the lack of political correctness, the more ridding ourselves of affirmative action, picking people that are most worthy of those college positions or those office jobs? Don't you think that, isn't it amazing to you that people think this is terrible stuff and the other half of the country thinks it's fantastic stuff? To the point where the former Democratic president says we all agree it's dark days? We don't, and I don't. Hi, everyone. I'm Brian Kilmeade. It gives me great pleasure to tell you that Simply Safe is now available at 50% off because you're listening to this podcast. So go to simplysafe.com/Brian. Now, why is Simply Safe so perfect? Number one, it's easily put in. Number two, it's unbelievably effective. Number three, they're using AI now to stop the break-in, not just catch the people that are doing it, but to stop them before they infiltrate your life and destroy your personal property. I personally trust these people. This is a game changer. The agents take action while the intruder is still on the outside. They confront the intruder, letting them know they're being watched on camera, and you know they're going to head for the hills because they're going to head right to prison if they don't, and hopefully they still will. There are no long-term contracts. There are no hidden fees. Get this, the U.S. News and World Report, they named them, Simply Safe, the best home security system. There's a 60-day money-back guarantee. So what price can you put on safety? Well, Simply Safe is easy to install. They're always improving the product, and it's affordable. Why can't you be safe? The answer is, of course you can. Go get Simply Safe. Save your 50% by going to simplysafe.com/Brian. Get it.
Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
We're evaluating this day by day. The House did its work. I've said it over and over and over. And the most important thing is to get the government open. It's the number one priority and number one responsibility of Congress. And the Senate Democrats have chosen not to do it. We think that is paramount and of paramount importance to everything else. There is plenty of time in the remainder of the calendar year to do all the things that are the must-pass pieces of legislation and all the negotiations that I referenced earlier today. And we are anxious to get everybody back to regular legislative session. But there cannot be a regular legislative session so long as the government is closed and Americans are feeling so much pain.
And I almost don't want to even play those sound bites because I'm so sick of hearing it for the last 27 days on both sides. They want a continuing resolution, continuing to fund the government. No, don't ask for anything for a Democrat, just continuing to fund the government. And what I think is Tim Kaine on Sunday, I think, started giving a pathway because he's experienced this. And he said, look, I don't trust President Trump to not cut programs that have already been greenlighted by Congress, which, remember, the USAID and remember what he did with PBS and NPR. They don't like that. So obviously, if you want an off-ramp, the president could say, look, I'm not going to cut any programs. I'll tell the OMB director not to do it. And in turn, we're going to look at two or three issues, guaranteed to look at these two or three issues and have debate on the floor on them while we try to pass appropriations bills. Something to give them an off-ramp. Because right now, you know, now you're denying people on food stamps food for no reason because you don't want to continue in the front of the government in order to win an election or do better in an election next year. It's kind of dumb. I mean, it's really dumb. Here's what Britt Hume said. Here's his analysis last night on Special Report Cup 41.
I think we're getting near to the end of this, not least because of the American Federation of Government Employees, as it was mentioned by Chad in his report, but also because the situation with air traffic control could become serious soon. And when flights start getting delayed and canceled and so on, the pressure to end this is going to be pretty great.
They're already happening. And what they're doing is they're lightening up the flights, going in and canceling flights, you know, before you get to the airport ahead of time, because they got to thin out the number of planes coming in because a lot of air traffic controllers aren't showing up. TSA agents are calling in sick, and they're tired of working and not getting paid, even though they're going to get back pay and eventually get it back. So that's where the shutdown stands. A major union has just left the Democrats and basically came out and said, get back to work, sign the CR, and then continue to negotiate. We know, too, that rates are going up on insurance because Obamacare sucks. It didn't work. It was supposed to have market pressures to bring prices down for all. It didn't happen. We could debate over and over again. A separate healthcare debate would probably need at least an hour, but it hasn't worked. So they're saying, how dare you not subsidize the bad program? And Democrat Republican said, no, I never said I was. Absolutely wasn't. But I'm negotiating some way to get premiums down because, you know, through no fault of your own, you're forced to take Obamacare and you see premiums go up 200% and you think, how am I going to afford that? So Republicans don't dislike you and say it's tough. We don't even know if you voted for it. We're not voted for it. You do want to fix it, but now while you hold up the government. So I can't believe all this. This is continuing to happen. Senator John Thune weighed in last night. He was on with Hannity. Cut 38.
And that's how they view this. This is a big political game. This is to make a bunch of people on their far left, the people who were probably at the rally last weekend for Mondami in New York. That's the kind of constituency that the Democrats are appealing to right now. And unfortunately, the you know, millions of Americans are going to get impacted by this. There are already millions of Americans who aren't getting paychecks who work for the federal government.
Yeah, it's already happening. And I was last night I spoke at Mount Vernon. I was asked to speak there by the Heritage Foundation. And there were a lot of staffers were there. So the congressmen and women get paid. The senators get paid. The president gets paid. Doesn't accept a salary. But you know who doesn't get paid? The people making $30,000 a year, probably working 80 hours a week. They're missing a paycheck. Really? In D.C., you know how expensive those rents are? Then you think to yourself, well, this is a major thing. Funding defense, not funding defense. You know, the big debate on priorities with the budget. But this is a continuing resolution to have those debates. It's a delay a game in order to make a decision down the line. Just guarantee you're going to make a decision. For Democrats, it's all posturing for getting the midterms, at least getting the House, and then having momentum when you run for the presidency. So do they have it? I'm not sure, especially if you look at what's happening with the off-year elections. In New Jersey, Jack Cittarelli picked up his 13th Democratic mayoral endorsement. 13! I haven't seen a poll that had him within 5, but also when he came within 3 of Murphy, he was down 8 on average in all those polls. But in terms of who the next leader, Democratic leader is, Gavin Newsom wants it to be him. That's what Project 50 is all about. He said, we have a neutral board that decided where the congressional districts are. Schwarzenegger made sure of that. So Newsom says, I want a partisan board that is going to redistrict Republicans right out of this state. Instead of 7, why don't we try 0 on? So he calls it Prop 50. He put a referendum up on the ballot. If he wins, he's going to go, look at the momentum I have. If he loses, he'll have zero momentum, but he'll say that at least I tried. In terms of who he's going to be going against, Kamala Harris made it clear it's her. Cut 48.
When are they going to see a woman in charge in the White House?
In their lifetime, for sure.
Could it be you? Possibly. Have you made a decision yet?
No, I have not.
But you say in your book, I'm not done.
That is correct. I am not done. I have lived my entire career a life of service, and it's in my bones. And there are many ways to serve. I've not decided yet what I will do in the future beyond what I am doing right now.
So she thinks that there's a groundswell for her. She raised over $1 billion, had the whole party behind her. They had no choice. They wanted to stop Trump. She's a bad candidate. Couldn't win a primary, couldn't last in a primary. She has no idea about spending money. She blew $1 billion. Her campaign still owes money to a lot of people. So what are you going to do? Give me more money to lose, but this time the nomination? I don't think that Gavin Newsom in particular is worried about her, and neither does Charlie Spearing. He's the author of Amateur Hour. He was on Primetime, Cut 52.
You know that Gavin Newsom has really been worried about running against Kamala Harris in California. He avoided it for decades as they both rose up through California politics together. But this time, Gavin's not going to stand down. I'm told by Democratic strategists that he thinks that she had her turn and now he's ready to get on board. But wow, they both say, like, it's going to be an ugly fight if they get into the race together. They both know each other's secrets. They were both proteges of Willie Brown, and it could get quite ugly if they end up in a primary contest together.
Yeah, I would think so. And especially, it usually is ugly. I mean, that's why we always point to the battles between Bush 41 and Reagan. It got ugly. Pat Buchanan and Bush 41, it got ugly. John McCain and Mitt Romney, it got ugly. Bush and McCain, really ugly. Obama and Clinton were hating each other's guts. Hillary and Bill hated him for a long time, but they still put it aside to form Secretary of State and presidential partnership. And he did pick Hillary over Joe for who he thought would be the best president next in 2016. But a couple other things are happening I think is important to point out. There was a poll done, and you're not going to believe who was leading in the polls for the Democratic side. I couldn't believe this. Okay, it's New Hampshire, so it's just one state, but it's an early state. I don't know if they're going to try to move this again. Pete Buttigieg has got 19% support of those polled in New Hampshire. His closest opponent was 4 points away. You have 19% for Buttigieg. You have 8% for Sanders, 11% for Harris, AOC 14%, so within 5 points. I mean, it's so early. But I just cannot believe that Pete Buttigieg has got a four-point cushion on everybody. Bernie Sanders is 100 years old and not running. He's got 8% support. J.B. Pritzker has got 6%. So for those people who think, wow, look at the publicity he's getting. He's the anti-Trump, and he's proving everyone he's got the fight. So far, he hasn't really proven to any Democrat at all. Speaking of Democrats, one decided to take on Riley Gaines, and it is, drumroll please, AOC. Why? Because Riley Gaines has sticking up for against trans men in locker rooms. Why wouldn't she? That's how she got her name. And she pointed out that Leah Thomas beat her, that she came in fifth. So Riley Gaines, here's what AOC says. Here's the first one. Riley Gaines posted, we're being destroyed from within. And he talked about the ruling that gave Leah Thomas, like Woman of the Year or something at some events. So Riley Gaines, who famously was at the University of Pennsylvania with him, he was ranked 450th with the men, but the women, they won the national title. AOC responds to the complaints by Riley Gaines that he was in there. He said, you channel all this anger into a swim. He goes, why don't you channel all your anger at Riley Gaines into swimming faster? You wouldn't have come in fifth. Really? Do you think AOC knows anything about athletic achievement, the dedication it takes to come in fifth in the country as a Division I swimmer? To make the team, you are defying the odds. To swim 4 years, you're defying the odds. To start, you're defying the odds. To finish fifth, it's even smaller. And this non-athlete decides to say you should have swum faster because she lost to a guy who was 450 with the men and one with the women. So Gaines comes back and puts this on Twitter and says, it's always we support women's rights until it's a woman who wants the right to compete and undress free form less than media in front of mediocre men. Keep your mentally ill men out of our sports, locker rooms, and prisons. So AOC responds, and I would like to challenge this person to get a real job. And then Riley Gaines comes back and says, she has a real job, being a mom. I have a real job. I'm a mom. It's the most important, rewarding job in the world. I think you had a baby. If you had a baby girl like I do, you would understand my positions a little bit better. I mean, think about this. You are fighting an elite athlete about being a better athlete when they complain that men are swimming against her. It's insane. So Tommy Tuberville sewed it up when he said, what happened to support all women? And he wrote at AOC. 5-time SEC champion, 12-time NCAA All-American, not to mention she's a patriot who has fought every day for women and girls. Meanwhile, AOC thinks women's rights just means abortion. So I don't know why she gets in these idiotic fights. It's as ill-conceived as her Amazon fight, because they were getting tax breaks. She made sure that Amazon didn't open up in Long Island City, and they still have not recovered economically. Back in a moment.
Learning something new every day on The Brian Kilmeade Show. It's Will Kane Country. Watch it live at noon Eastern Monday through Thursday at foxnews.com or on the Fox News YouTube channel. And don't miss the show. Listen and follow the podcast 5 days a week at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you download your favorite podcasts. Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on The Brian Kilmeade Show.
This is a very bad actor sitting on top of the world's largest known reserves of oil, plus the critical minerals that will fuel the 21st century economy. and he's in bed with our strategic competitors.
And how has he been able to cling to power for as long as he has?
I mean, let's be very clear. This is a criminal organization masquerading as a government. This is an individual who is under indictment for narcotics trafficking, commits human rights violations, someone who has used the apparatus of the state to throw people in jail, to torture them, to kill them.
And that is a diplomat from the region who is James Story, who was talking about what's going on in Venezuela right now and how Maduro has stayed in power. Basically, he loses elections and refuses to leave. And people are supposed to buy and accept that. And Trump's not doing that. He has basically surrounded Venezuela with firepower. He just pulled in a destroyer into Trinidad and Tobago. When Trinidad took him, the Venezuela said, okay, we're cutting you off from oil. And they said, fine, we want to stop the drug scourge. We back America. Lieutenant Colonel Alan West, Dallas County Republican Party Chair, American Constitutional Rights Union Executive Director. Your thoughts on our strategy in the region, the best you could tell.
Well, Brian, it's a pleasure to be with you. I'm sorry I was at airborne training here in northern Florida, and I was in a parachute harness when you first called. I think it's very important that we do focus on South America and focus on that region. I think it's important that we look at the means by which we can cut off Maduro and his being able to resource himself by the drug trafficking and his collusion with the narco traffickers and going after them. For so long, we have not had any real military presence in that region under SOUTHCOM, Southern Command. And now we see that attention that has sorely been needed for at least 15 to 20 years because we have allowed the narco criminal terrorists to get too much of a foothold. We did focus on that back, you know, Colombia some years ago, but now we have really turned the eye onto that region, and it's important because we got to put the pressure on him. This is one of the main reasons that he's able to stay in power and the main reasons that he's funding himself. And we have to show those other countries in the region that we will stand by and support them.
I do. Listen, we don't want to just say overthrow a government, put our person in there. How about the person that won the election that had 70% of the vote? So we're not handpicking people. We also know, and it's not in our interest to say this because we're trying to do a deal with China. China's infiltrated all of Central and South America while other presidents have looked the other way. So they're trying to say enough of the Belt and Road program. Panama's out. Argentina, it's a matter of time. They're about to get out. And now they've got to do the same thing with Venezuela. But now with this guy in power, so we basically said enough, and this is it. But listen to what other people are saying about President Trump's approach to taking out these drug boats. Here's Senator Gallego.
No, it's murder. It's very simple. If this president feels that they're doing something illegally, then he should be using the Coast Guard. If there's an act of war, then you use our military, and then you come and talk to us first. But this is murder. It's sanctioned murder that he is doing that. And it's very simple for someone like him to talk about killing people or doing something in the name of war. He's never actually served. He's never actually pulled a trigger. And it's very dangerous what he's doing.
Okay. They're going back to the whole heel spurts thing, who didn't serve in Vietnam. It's murder. Why would you say that if you read in on this stuff? And you just watched Barack Obama kill terrorists from the sky and everybody around him. And I was not against that. Because we had to find a way to win the war on terror, and he didn't want to put anyone in Gitmo. So where was Gallego then?
Well, the thing is that it's Donald Trump, and if Donald Trump is doing it, it obviously has to be wrong. Look, we're talking about non-state, non-uniform belligerents who are operating on the battlefield in international waters. He does not need to go to Congress and get their mother may I. We're not declaring war against a nation state. That's what you have to do if you're declaring war. We are going after people that are basically terrorists. And how do you combat terrorism? You go after them with every means that you possibly can. So I think this is well within his executive powers, what he's doing. And if, you know, the Congress is getting the appropriate briefings, but we don't need to tie the president's hand. Right now, we are inflicting much damage upon them, and they're starting to lose money.
That's key. We can't be dealing with these guys. We can't say, well, we're not going to pick leaders. We've had a run at Maduro. We've tried many different things. And the guy is a bus driver that inherited that position from Hugo Chavez, and who was mentored by Castro. So that's enough. Enough with that in this region. This president's going to do something about it. And I'm sorry that these guys can only see politics, including Senator Kelly. Lieutenant Colonel Alan West, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Brian.
All right.
Sir.
Lewis and the Brian Kilmeade Show. Don't forget, November 1st, this Saturday, I'm going to be at History, Liberty, and Laughs in beautiful Pottstown, Pennsylvania, streaming on Fox Nation. You're going to love it. Go get your tickets.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. So glad you're there. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show, and I'm in 48th and 6th in Midtown Manhattan, where I can't wait for my taxes to go up. You know what they were chanting on Sunday? And Governor Kathy Hochul, while he's sitting there, tax the rich. I mean, what is this? What are we in Russia? Tax the rich. What are you, crazy? I mean, the rich already pay $6 out of every $10 they take. If you take local taxes, the city taxes, state taxes, federal taxes, $6 out of every $10 goes to taxes. So keep $4 of every 10 because of the most productive, successful people on the planet. I cannot wait to talk to Mike Pillsbury. He's with the Heritage Foundation, senior fellow for China Strategy, author of the 100-Year Marathon. We are waiting for the president to get to South Korea, where he's going to meet with the Chinese leader, at which time we hear a deal's virtually done. And then Michael Pillsbury will tell me what to look for in it. Congressman David Kustoff will be with us, too. And then we'll do a simulcast on FBN with Stuart Varney. So let's get to the big three.
Number three.
Everybody in this room knows exactly what's going on. And it's so infuriating to us. The best way for SNAP benefits to be paid on time is for the Democrats to end their shutdown. And that can happen right now if they would show some spine.
That is Speaker Johnson, who might be calling his Republican House members back. Day 27, and it looks like the base of the Democratic Party is beginning to break, if not their voters, and evidently some senators got to be wrangled. But one of the biggest unions in the country said, sign the CR and get back to work. Two Democrats.
Number two.
This guy is somebody who's got real chops, and that transcends what you stand for, right or left or somewhere in between. I think that's why he's poised to win, why he won so convincingly in the primary earlier this year.
Governor Cuomo closes in on Madami as Main Street Democrats begin to fall in line for the 34-year-old communist. They kissing his feet, Hakeem Jeffries on Sunday and Mayor Pete on Monday. Meanwhile, Jack Cittarelli in New Jersey picks up more Democratic mayoral support in New Jersey. Will that convert to a win?
Number one.
It's a whirlwind presidency. He's taking on more major issues than any president I can ever remember. I mean, sometimes, you know, issues are thrust on presidents. He's come into office and taken on four major foreign policy initiatives.
It takes a lot to impress Brit Hume, and he's pretty impressed. The Trump trip, a massive success so far, and attitude is everything. He's energized. He's cutting rare earth deals with Malaysia, inspiring address to troops with Japan, and the prime minister there to also address our troops, who they then turned around and did Japan committed to spending between $350 and $500 billion in American products, including opening up Toyota plants. And a surprise summit with Kim Jong-un could end this trip. But in between on Thursday, it's going to be a meeting with President Xi. Joining us now, Mike Pillsbury. Michael, we're hearing good things about a possible deal with China. What are you hearing?
Well, the same thing, Brian. A key word that's being used is the framework, not an actual deal that will be signed with dollar amounts of soybeans or exactly when the next shipment of rare earth magnets will come. It's not that kind of deal. A so-called framework is the word Scott Bessent has used several times now. That to me means no details are agreed to yet. It's awfully hard to get Xi Jinping, who's under threat himself from internal politics for his mistakes, to get him to come to the table is President Trump's first big miracle, I think. The second miracle is the patience President Trump has shown. You know, he had Scott Bessent go off to Madrid, Stockholm, London, Geneva, almost every European capital for these 1 or 2 day meetings. They didn't produce any agreement either. They kept using the phrase, well, we had constructive talks. That means no deal was struck. So we're still going down to the wire in this meeting, which sometimes it takes 2 or 3 hours for even it's called the summit one-on-one. 2 or 3 hours where the two heads of state are going to go back and forth. I think they won't be bickering. I don't think it'll be an auction. I don't think Xi Jinping will say, how about 100 billion soybeans? And Trump then say, how about 200 billion soybeans? It won't be like that. But we need to see some kind of action come out of this meeting. Worst case is they cancel the trips they've already announced. You know, Mr. Trump has said he and Melania are going to Beijing in about 3 months. And then he's invited Xi Jinping and his wife, Madame Peng, who's actually a general in the military, folk singer, that they're coming to Washington, D.C. So that's the good news of is that if those two trips take place in the coming 6 months or so, we can get more concessions on trade, more jobs for Americans, and a safer Taiwan. If there's a walkout, the worst case is a walkout, or the meeting is canceled at the last minute, or they can't agree on anything at the meeting. So what I'll be watching for, Brian, is something in between the walkout, canceling the future trips, or kumbaya, you know, China is going to buy $200 billion in soybeans in the next 3 or 4 years. That's would be
actually, I think they're going to start buying immediately. The word is they might have gone beyond framework in the last 24 hours. And they're really optimistic it's going to be a major deal, including immediately buying soybeans. That's the key. If you ask these farmers, they need them sold yesterday. So you can't be like, okay, it's coming down the pike. I'll see you in a month. And we're going to send chips there. No. It's got to be right away. So, and we're not asking a favor. We got the best stuff and for the best price that have already been a proven commodity for China. And I understand, too, the rare earth deal, at least for a year, they won't touch it. But I think the U.S. made huge progress in trying to counter that checkmate that they have. And that's Malaysia signing a minerals deal. That's Thailand signing a processing deal.
Right.
And that is a deal with Australia. And I think Argentina is also on the precipice, including getting some of these Central and South American countries to leave the Belt and Road program like China did. So I think there might be some movement.
Yeah, that's the optimistic side, Brian. I'm trying to give you both sides. In terms of soybeans, they promised very specifically last time in January 2020, and then they didn't do it. And everybody kept waiting day by day after Xi Jinping signed the deal. And he never bought additional soybeans, nothing like what he promised to do. That's why I'm underlining the bad side for you, the downside. This kind of summit isn't necessarily scripted. You know, the topics are brought up by either side, and there's no sort of checklist. Okay, now we talk about Taiwan. Now we talk about ring magnets. That's what concerns me always, is when you don't have a draft communique ready to be signed by the two leaders, which they've made clear they don't have yet. Things can go bad.
So I want you to hear what they did do. Evidently, China is really pushing Trump on Taiwan to soften his support. They want Trump to come out and say he does not support an independent Taiwan. He wants him to say Trump opposes Taiwan's independence. He said to incrementally move it forward, and the next leader gets closer and closer to saying essentially, do with Taiwan what you did with Hong Kong, just go take it back. So they're really hyper-focused on this. And, you know, Trump has not dug in like past presidents on Taiwan, although he says, I don't think they're going to take it, and I think he would back it. In fact, he's been critical of them to a degree, and he's right, saying stop spending 2% on your GDP, do it 5%, and they said, we will. And they say, why have you locked up all the chips? We should be sharing in that, but a free market goes to where it wants to. Your thoughts about China's focus on Taiwan, and what would that mean to them for the president to say he does not support an independent Taiwan?
Well, you're right. But right now, our position has been for 7 presidents. In Mandarin, we say Biao Zhichi. Zhichi means support. We don't support independence for Taiwan. That's the current situation. President Trump's already endorsed that in a Truth Social about a month and a half ago. Part of getting to these talks is he tweeted or X'd, I support the One China policy. Now, what Beijing wants, and you're quite right, there's heavy pressure from Beijing. I don't think President Trump's going to give into it. They want him to say something they've asked previous presidents. The previous presidents have all said no. They want him to say, we oppose, in Mandarin, it's fan dui. We oppose independence. That implies we'll do something to stop the trend on Taiwan toward independence. This is a huge issue between Pompeo and Trump. Pompeo twice flew to Taiwan and said, I am for immediate diplomatic recognition of Taiwan. Trump won't do that. Trump says, no, I'm sticking with the previous 7 presidents that I don't support. So that's where we're left. I would be astonished if Trump went all the way and said, I oppose and I will intervene to prevent Taiwan going independent. That's the big issue. But you're quite right. This is the biggest issue of the meeting.
So Michael, the one thing I believe is happening is that I think China's got real problems. And the real estate problem that they have, the commercial real estate, the fact that nobody wants to invest there, that new companies aren't opening up there because of the restrictions. They thought, well, we're going to put up with it because we want their market. It doesn't look like the Chinese have any excess income. They have no social safety net. Mm-hmm. So they're not spending. So when we say, well, we want to open up the markets to American products, I even think to myself, so what? They can't buy anything. The younger people aren't working. And they don't seem to have, at this point, much national pride that's, you know, the patriotic pride that they maybe had in the past. We know about the damage the one-child policy has had on their country. Mm-hmm. And even though they're very smart in locking up rare earth and smart to build up their military and smart to try to get in to all these countries with the Belt and Road program, I don't necessarily think it's working out too well.
Well, they're afraid of their own economic deterioration. You're quite right about that. The problem Trump faces, I think, is things that Biden could have done but did not do. One of them is the rare minerals. They knew about this, but they took none of the steps President Trump is taking, and God bless him for doing it. Biden could have done all that himself. He could have had a new agreement with Malaysia and Australia. He could have nailed down, you know, no export licenses for global ring magnet exports. Biden didn't do any of that. In fact, Biden didn't even have one round, Brian, not even a single round of trade talks by this woman named Katherine Tai, who probably no one's ever heard of. She's the head of USTR. So their economy could be in trouble, but that does not affect the nationalism of Xi Jinping and his ability to run China into the ditch. He could make economic mistakes, make the economy even worse, just to look tough against Mr. Trump. Again, Brian, I'm trying to introduce you to the downside of what could happen. Partly knowing the downside means if Trump succeeds, this is a miracle. This is a huge achievement, just to get to the meeting and get a framework done. I'll be applauding and having a glass of champagne high in the air if just that much happens.
And listen, I agree with everything, and no one knows China better than you. You wrote a book about it, and you spent your career there. But I will say the pandemic and the election has a lot to do with China not fulfilling what they were supposed to be doing. You know, we even forgot about phase one of this trade deal because Trump lost and the pandemic came in, and they did it and have not paid one dime in restitution for it. So we don't really think about phase one. So I do think that factors in to a degree. But get this. I think China reportedly is starting to level off on their Russian oil purchases. And I got a report that they're going to make an announcement about that and the war in Ukraine. Now, look, we know they're tighter with Russia than they are with us. I get it. I'm totally, my eyes are wide open. But when it's a detriment to them on the global stage and they're looking to win us over to get access to our markets or relief on tariffs, they might be saying, you know what, guys, you know, take your foot off the gas. Because they did not have bad relations with Ukraine prior to the invasion.
That's right. And China actually has its own Ukraine peace plan. It's kind of pro-Russian, but it's partly in between the American plan and China's own ideas. But what I'm afraid about is Trump needs to get a lot of credit if this works out. And I don't think we should be casual or overly optimistic that it's going to happen for sure because we're strong and China's weak. It could happen. I hope it does. But a huge amount of effort's gone into this by President Trump in his second term. In his first term, as you and I know very well, Brian, he was always fighting with Rex Tillerson or Jim Mattis or John Bolton.
That's what I was just talking about.
So now he's got a real team that works for him. And I wish them a huge celebration if they pull this off.
Right. And I think that Rubio says, you know, when asked his opinion, he knows to do it, but he knows who he'll give it. And he knows, but he's in, you know, he's very tough on China. Didn't China ban him from traveling there? I don't know if that's going to be even alleviated for this trip, even though they're going to meet in South Korea if it ever happens. So I know he's just as tough on China, maybe as Pompeo, but he's going to say, Mr. President, what do you need me to do? And then he's going to say, if he says, Marco, what do you think? Marco will tell him. And that's what works. Right. And that's basically what works in companies.
Marco Rubio won me over, Brian, when he held up a copy of my book on the floor of the Senate. He said everybody should read The 100-Year Marathon by Michael Pillsbury. So you can't be more of a fan than I am of Marco Rubio. But I think you're right. He knows who the boss is, and he's put aside some of his really harsh anti-communist views in order to follow this Trump strategy. of the two couples exchanging state visits in the coming year. That's the success that I'm really looking for, because more concessions can come out of China, Brian, once they get past this obstacle and start looking for even more details. And frankly, I think President Trump wants China to help the American growth rate. Remember, bringing back our jobs, expanding the markets in China under pressure for our companies. This is part of President Trump's dream that he wrote in a book 15 years ago, very clearly. But he also said in that book, the Chinese are the world's best negotiators. He says, I decided not to invest in China because they're such good negotiators, I couldn't make any profit out of it. So Trump's got a kind of a positive view of how the negotiating skills of the Chinese side. That's why I say it'll be a miracle if he pulls all this off.
But by the way, whether he believes it or not, it's a great thing to say for a country that prides itself on its pride. Hey, you guys are great. Right. You know, you're going to get over on me. I'm a little wary about going in here. It's a great play, you know, so Michael Pillsbury, I should have booked you on Friday. That's what I should have done to analyze the aftermath of the meeting. But thanks. Always great to have you on. Thanks, Michael.
Thanks, Brian.
All right. Listen, we're going to keep our fingers crossed. It's going to work. The markets, I tell you, are pretty convinced over the last 2 days that it's going to work. Back in a moment.
It's Brian Kilmeade. The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Well, it's pretty hard to argue, Brett, that the White House doesn't need a ballroom. I mean, I'm sure that you had this experience, too. I was occasionally, when I was a White House correspondent, occasionally invited to state dinners. And I can remember one state dinner, at least, where people were dancing in the lobby. That's because they don't have a ballroom. They have some large rooms, the East Room and the state dining room, but they're small. I think most people end up liking it, and I think that the future presidents are going to end up liking it a lot because they can now hold events of a sufficient size to accommodate all the guests they might like to have, whereas now they have to hold it in tents outside with guests invited to use porta-potties to go to the bathroom.
You know, everything, Brett, you've said is so honest and to the point. I mean, this guy's not into rhetoric or punditry. He's just saying flat out, you know, he'll call out Trump. But can you imagine going to a party and dancing in the lobby? So, like, obviously the music's not in the lobby. So you're dancing in the lobby with the music in another room. You must really love to dance. Was it J-Lo or something?
I think they were talking about you.
No, I'm pretty sure they weren't. Yeah, but I mean, I've never seen anyone freak out like this. The thing about Trump, and this is what's interesting. You notice the Washington Post and New York Times did an editorial about the need to do this, to get a ballroom. And, you know, they saluted Trump for cutting through the red tape, and they compared it in the Washington Post to the New York, into the cities that Ezra Klein wrote about, a Democrat. He said, big cities have failed. Fareed Zakaria says big cities have failed, and they're run by Democratic mayors because you can't get anything done. There's too many rules and regulations. What Trump said, if I get this privately funded, do I have to check with anyone? Do I have to go to this historical society? Well, you know, sir, okay, I'm doing it. You know what? If I want it the right size, you really got to take the whole room out. Okay, I'm doing it. And they're like, well, what about this? What about that? Well, Trump's not doing, he's not waiting. And I think the Washington Post and New York Times, to have at least one editorial that takes his side, shows a different approach to Trump too. Maybe for good.
The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
I wish you all the best. Honestly, you know, I think any New Yorker who looks at someone getting an opportunity, who's representing communities that have not been as represented, a Muslim, a young person, a progressive, a democratic socialist, you know, there are so many different communities that are looking to you, and this, I hate to put it on you, as a bit of a Jackie Robinson moment. And I know that probably wields some weight, but man, oh man, what an exciting opportunity.
Thank you.
And I wish you the best.
Thank you.
Wow. I guess I know who's voting for. John Stewart. You know, I don't know. Allison, did you watch all of it? You haven't watched all of it? Because I'm wondering, does he ask questions about taxing the rich and the people leaving the city, the cops, the racist? Does he ask any of that stuff? Cops are racist?
I haven't gone through all of it yet, but the first part.
Because he usually will, won't he?
He will sometimes, but I will let you know after I get through the rest of it. But at first, they were just joking around about how much New Yorkers love it when you knock on their door and they want to talk to people. So it's been very friendly from what I've seen so far.
And the thing is, he's only run against Democrats. So Curtis, you know, it's not like Curtis is neck and neck with him and he's got to go, I got to make sure the Democrat wins. You got another guy there who they were worshiping for a great big period of time until he left the governor's mansion in disgrace. So, you know, you're talking about Cuomo. I mean, if Cuomo was winning against Curtis, like Eric Adams was winning against Curtis, he would have had Cuomo on and treated him like a savior, I would imagine.
Probably. I think so. Or maybe he would have asked some hard questions to Cuomo. We'll see. But the congressman would love to weigh in on this,
yep, too. Congressman David Kustoff joins us now from Tennessee, Ways and Means, chairman of the House Committee on the Knesset Parliamentary Friendship Group, which, by the way, is extremely needed. We need constant vigilance on this Gaza deal with Hamas. And the Parliamentary Friendship Group with the Israeli Knesset. It's one of his focuses. Congressman, right now, I hear that the speaker's close to bringing you back to Washington. Have you heard that?
Brian, good morning. In fact, we're going to have a call, the Republican congressman, with Speaker Johnson in about an hour, so we're going to get more direction. I do think that the speaker's strategy has been exactly right, and it's unfortunate the way things have evolved, but just as a reminder, the House of Representatives over a month ago, September the 19th, took this vote to authorize a clean continuing resolution so the federal government would continue to operate. I mean, it is basic stuff, and we passed it out of the House with virtually no Democrat support, one Democrat congressman. So the speaker has been right in saying that, you know what, this is all on the United States Senate, because the House of Representatives has done its part. Now, the Senate has voted something like 12 times on the same continuing resolution that we voted on and that we passed in September. It is real. And my thinking is that the Democrat senators need to pass this clean continuing resolution, no one-off bills to pay one group of employees or another group or to keep SNAP. We need to do all of it, and we need to do all of it in one vote. But we'll know more a little bit later this morning once we have that phone call with Speaker Johnson.
All right. But if you go back, one of the things that they were saying, they want to avoid swearing in this Arizona congresswoman because it would narrow the balance between between the Democrats and Republicans. Anything to that?
You know, once we're back in and we're in regular order, then that new congressman-elect will get sworn in. And the speaker has decided, and I think rightly so, that we haven't been in session since September the 19th. That is the fault of the Democrats. But as soon as we come back in and we're fully functioning, then she'll be sworn in as a new member of Congress.
How do you feel about Mondami? He's up now. His point, it was a 20-point lead. Now it's down to a 10-point lead over to the famed Governor Cuomo. Here he is, now wants to make 9/11 about him. Listen to this, cut 16.
I want to use this moment to speak to the Muslims of New York City. I want to speak to the memory of my aunt, who stopped taking the subway after September 11th because she did not feel safe in her hijab.
Right. And by the way, that is what 9/11 is about, how people feel Muslims felt unsafe in the subway. Are you kidding? And then it turns out it gets worse. It turns out there was no aunt. Cut 17.
Yes, I was speaking about my aunt. I was speaking about Zerafui, my father's cousin, who sadly passed away a few years ago. And for the takeaway from my more than 10-minute address about Islamophobia in this race and in this city to be the question of my aunt tells you everything about Andrew Cuomo and his inability to reckon with a crisis of his own making.
So they couldn't even find this aunt. It made no sense. He probably made it up. And he got choked up, too. What do you think about this candidate that John Stewart seems to love?
Well, it's kind of throwing spaghetti up against the wall and seeing what sticks. The fact of the matter is, after 9/11, a lot of people in New York and all over the country were afraid to do a lot of things, like getting on an airplane for a period of time. I'm deeply concerned, obviously, with his past comments that is anti-Semitic, that are anti-Semitic, the border on anti-Semitic, and You've got something like 650 rabbis who have signed a letter urging people, certainly their congregations and others, not to vote for him. It's ironic to me that the city that represents free markets and capitalism and the center of the financial world could, in fact, after the election, be governed by somebody who's a socialist. And to me, that you know, I'm in Tennessee. We have a lot of businesses that move from New York to Tennessee for a lot of different reasons, including no state income tax and no inheritance tax. It would be good for Tennessee if Mondami wins, but it's certainly bad. It's certainly
for the country.
Bad for
the it's terrible
nation,
for the country.
Bad for New York, absolutely.
How about this? Can you imagine being at an event in America and saying "tax the rich"? They were chanting "tax the rich" in Forest Hills. By the way, for the record, $6 out of every $10 for New Yorkers goes to the city, state, and federal dollars. How much more do you want the successful people to work, and how little money should they keep?
Well, I think the governor heard them the crowd chant "Let's go Bills."
Did you believe that? You're not kidding. No, that's what she said.
No. Which is absolutely amazing. You know, we just had these debates on Capitol Hill when we passed the One Big Beautiful Bill to lower everybody's tax burden nationwide. Obviously, Mondami's taking the exact opposite message, but there's no doubt that will further drive people out of New York City and out of New York State to other places. You know, what this giant surge in early voting in New York City means is anybody's guess. It's I suspect that there are older voters who are concerned, who are going to the polls, who are not voting for Mondami during early voting. But it's an example, Brian, what we know about every election. Number one, we can look at polls all day long. I think every poll before November 2024 showed that Trump wasn't going to win any of the swing states. The seven swing states that wasn't going to win very many.
Yeah,
he won all of them. So it really doesn't matter until the election is done. But you know, for the sake of New York City, people need to vote. They need to vote for somebody other than Mondami. But politically, if that guy wins, he is the new face of the Democrat Party.
No question.
Something that me and other people are going to be talking about all of next year.
Believe me, not only that, you know, no one's going to run from him. Hakeem Jeffries took until last 2 days ago to not endorse him. Schumer still hasn't. Gillibrand still hasn't. But he'll be somebody that raises a lot of money like AOC and Bernie Sanders and get big crowds. But you're not going to win over the people of Indiana. You're not going to win over the people of Wisconsin. You're not going to win these seats by marching out a 34-year-old unproven socialist who would be called a communist if it was legal.
That's right. And you know, you look at other elections, Brian, nationwide. There are local elections where, in San Francisco, for example, where they elected a far left woke DA only to recall him because the policies were too far left. The people of the
Ches
city
Bodine,
of New York are going to greatly regret it if they elect him as the mayor. But the good thing about elections, again, is it's not done until it's done, and people go out and vote and take their message. And so Cuomo and Curtis need to go out and take their message out to everybody. Mm. And they've got to make sure that it translates, that they actually get the people to go vote.
Right. And you got to cooperate. When the president comes in to try to rein in crime, you can't make ICE the enemy. Congressman David Kastoff, thanks so much.
Thank you, Brian. Thank you for having me today.
You got it. Listen, we come back, I'm going to do a simulcast with Stuart Varney and then squeeze in some calls on the back half. So I'll be able to get to all of you. So right before the top of the hour, 1-866-408-7669.
Don't go anywhere. Brian Kilmeade will be right back. Now, the Brian Kilmeade Show joins Fox Business's Varney & Company with Stuart Varney, live on your radio and on Fox Business. Here's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back. Again, I'll have a couple of minutes at the back end to take some of your calls, so I'll get to and punch them up. We're going to talk about what's happening with this mayor's race. In case you don't know, it's 44-34 over Cuomo with 12% going to Curtis. So he went up a couple of percentage points, but it looks like Cuomo got the Adams votes. That according to one Fox News poll. Look, it's 1,000 people. But the one thing that's different about this race that no one's taken into account, I don't think, is that only very few people showed up for de Blasio to win, like 20%. I think people are showing up early. The early voting is already outstripping all levels over the last three or four runs. It was inevitable that Bloomberg was going to win. People stayed home. He got three terms, remember? And then you had de Blasio win because nobody cared. They thought the city was unbreakable at this point. He broke it. Then Adams goes in 70-30. And now we'll see what happens. So let's listen in.
A month ago, now 1:14. It is now 10:51 Eastern time. That means it's time for Brian Kilmeade. Brian, polling shows Mandami now only up 10 points. Last month, he was 20 points ahead of Cuomo. You think Cuomo's got a chance?
Well, look, I've never seen somebody down by 10 win, but let's say that poll, Fox News poll, is showing a trend that gives you some momentum. But, I mean, you also already had a Mamdani story about his Muslim aunt being hassled in the subway. The holes put through that. You saw how angry he was at Forest Hills. You hear in the interview, he's saying that if Jessica Tisch, I want her to stay as police chief, but she'll answer to me. Really? Okay. So Mr. Law and Order, who is on the record calling cops anti-gay and racist, is now going to order around the police commissioner, who is, they say, one of their concerns is, we're electing you to reform police. We're afraid that you're not going to do it because you're hiring Jessica Tisch. So that all of a sudden makes people feel unnerved. Also, I saw this interesting stat, is that 60% of all voters are 50 and up. The breadbasket for Mandami is under 30. Yeah. So they have to not only show up and hold oak tag signs up and show up as events, they got to show up again and vote, which they haven't done at all recently. And I also saw that 80% of undecideds are 50 and up. That's what seemed to me logically to break towards Cuomo, a known quantity in terms of somebody with inexperience. And we've never hired somebody like this to run a city like this.
You think I ought to stop saying that Mandami is a surefire winner? Because I have been saying that for several weeks, if not months. Maybe I should be quiet. What do you think?
I would say let's wait for a couple more polls. I mean, we just say this, Stuart. We've never seen somebody like this who was supposed to get crushed in ranked choice voting by Cuomo to the point where Cuomo didn't show up, to now somebody who's looked at as, according to Mayor Pete, very energetic. You can learn a lot from him. His affordability, his ideas are great. Really? His ideas are great. Hakeem Jeffries on Sunday falling at his feet. Now, if this guy wins, he is going to be everywhere. But the message he brings is going to be a message of socialism. The rich are the problem. When people show up to your events and they say, tax the rich, you're setting up class warfare. They don't understand capitalism, where the most successful people in our country make it run. And give people jobs. And they're the ones who pay the bulk of the taxes and pay the bulk to charities and soup kitchens. He doesn't like that math. So that's the guy they're going to put in power. That's the guy that's going to be trying to win battleground states. So that's why Democrats are worried.
They are indeed worried. I've got to bring this one up to you. I've got a ballroom story, okay? MSNBC host is trashing President Trump's ballroom plans, while admitting that their parent company, that's Comcast, is helping pay the bill. Watch this.
Donors are paying for it. Corporations are paying for it. Comcast is one of those that are underwriting this. Shouldn't that be more concerning to the American people? Because there ain't no company out there writing a check just for goodwill.
Brian, sounds like MSNBC and Comcast are not on the same page. What do you say?
It sounds like they're not. And here's a couple of things where people should understand. You sponsor events, you want to be associated with it. The White House, not with Trump. Trump is holding a lease. The White House stays. So they're giving to America. It's like putting a sponsored by in the Smithsonian. This wing is brought to you by this charitable family. They don't want anything out of it. They're saying, with my money, I'd like to be associated with America. Man, I got a chance to be in the White House for generations. I am in. Believe me, if that's Trump, the capitalist, saying, let me see, are there other patriotic people out there that want to give? He's not saying, take the money and put it to my library and I'll decide how much money goes into the ballroom. He's saying, there's the money, pay them. I don't think she understands that. You know what bothers her? That the Washington Post and New York Times both have editorials lauding the way this was done, cutting through red tape, and the need for a ballroom in the White House because they've all experienced it.
They just can't stand anything that Trump does at any time, in any
way. It's getting boring, right?
Any place.
It's getting boring.
It is, actually. It is. It's still fun, though. Yeah. Brian Kilmeade, you're all right. We'll see you again soon. Thanks.
All right. Thanks so much. 1-866-408-7669. So when we look at what's going on with Jessica Tisch, this is what I think I could be. I said it right. I think that she could be the linchpin. I don't want her. I was with Paul Morrow today on the couch on Fox and Friends, and he's an investigator, former NYPD officer. I don't want her to get the job and leave after 3 months when she realizes she wants to change the way the NYPD functions, doesn't want to hire any new cops, send social workers out for domestic abuse situations, put on civilians when it comes to disciplining and judging cops who are in disputed and controversial situations. And she goes, in March, I'm done. It's not going to work for me. That's not good because we're stuck with this guy for 4 years. But being that she's so popular and the numbers are so effective, and I mean this, and that other police commissioners couldn't thrive under Eric Adams, who's way too hands-on with the NYPD, she should say, I just want to make it clear. I don't know what the plans are for the next mayor, but if it's Zohran Mamdani, I am not interested in serving. She's already got a situation where she'll be a consultant for the biggest, most successful security companies in the country. Absolutely. Look at her experience. New York City, keeping it safe, anti-terror, law enforcement. How to grow a police force in real time, how to work through controversies. She'll go anywhere. She doesn't need to get this pay for this long. So I say that she should make it clear. I know there's talk of me staying on, but if it's Mamdani, I'm not. You know, Ray Kelly yesterday probably did something he didn't want to do. He said, I've known Curtis Lee for 30, 40 years, but I'm endorsing Cuomo because I don't want that guy. Because he's inexperienced. He doesn't like the country, in my view, and he'll destroy the city. Besides that, I think he's great. Brian Kilmeade Show.
From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. We come to you from Midtown Manhattan, where there's going to be a big election 1 week from today. And, of course, there's a big election in Virginia. People are going to be watching the governor's race, the attorney general's race, and in New Jersey, where more Republicans are moving in and a lot of Democrats are moving out. And taxes are extremely high, and so are utility costs, making a Democratic win, which many people thought was inevitable, very much questionable. So we got the details on that. You're one-stop shopping for all this. We got this hour, Julian Epstein, longtime Democrat, and he has a new article out, how Democrats threw a government shutdown, and no one cared. And it really is, in my view, this is on the Democrats. I told you in 2013 when Julian Epstein and some of the Freedom Caucus a little bit later said, we're just going to sit this out. We're not going to vote for this, and we're going to shut down the government until you change Obamacare. Well, you don't have no leverage. All you have is the ability to shut things down. Well, they had to come back, and they lost. This is the exact opposite. It's the Democrats who are going to shut it down on something that wasn't even being discussed. We weren't even getting through the cabinet discussion on health care. So it's kind of odd. Julian Epstein joins us now. He served as chief counsel to the House Judiciary Committee and staff director of the House Oversight Committee for 5 to 6 years. He's been a Democrat all his life. Julian, what's your reaction to Democrats now rallying around Mamdani? Hakeem Jeffries on Sunday. Mayor Pete didn't endorse him, but now praising him as basically the future of the party yesterday, putting down Governor Cuomo.
Well, good morning, Brian. Thanks for having me on. I think the hurricane that the Democrats are swimming into is the fact that every single candidate between now and the 2028 election is going to be asked the question as to whether they support Mamdani, whether they endorse Mamdani. And they're all going to have no real easy or clear answer. They're going to try to dance around that question, and they're going to look silly. What Mamdani represents is economic socialism, a cultural revolution, and an alignment with terrorists, Nazi-like terrorists. Democrats have sort of made this decision to embrace the very ideas that led them into the wilderness. They got their hat handed to them in the 2024 election. And rather than confronting the fact that they are trying to push onto voters ideas that are very unpopular, they are succumbing to the very forces that led them into the wilderness. This is ultimately a sign of weakness on the part of the party leadership, who fears the insurgent socialist left rather than trying to confront them.
Yeah. Here's what Mayor Pete said. Cut 20.
I don't live in New York, but I think he has the capacity to be a great mayor. I think right now has been taking a lot of steps that are not just about winning, but about trying to bring people together, which is something that I think a lot of people didn't see in him or expect from him earlier on in the campaign.
Let me just tell Mayor Pete, no, he's not bringing anybody together. You know, he has people that are supporting him, but he's not adding, he's shedding. And he had over 50% of the vote. The last poll, it's 44-34. So it's a 10-point spread. Well, Mayor Pete didn't endorse, but he has the ability. And what program is promising? What program? The free buses lose hundreds of millions of dollars. They are so out of money, they're charging you to drive across the city. Congestion pricing now. He's going to make it all free?
Yeah, well, what we've seen in previous generations is they have attempted to confront the challenges, the economic challenges that are in the next coming years. What this idea is, the socialist idea that Mandami presents, is the idea of just giving free stuff to the downwardly mobile podcast class to usher in a new cultural revolution based on identity. And again, I think the terrorist sympathizer stuff, the fact that Mandami is photographed with the imam who was an unindicted conspirator in the 93 World Trade attack, World Trade Center attack. These are just going to be questions that are, you know, these things are popular with the deep blue, urban, mostly white, progressive community. They're incredibly unpopular with the rest of the country. So what the Democrats, again, are doing is they're choosing to align with progressives who want to be a big fish in a smaller pond, rather than to play to the voters, the general electorate, and be smaller fish in a bigger pond. This is a sign of weakness. It's a sign, sort of, I think, of self-dealing by progressives. But it's also a sign that I think a cold war inside the Democratic Party is soon going to become a hot war. And this kind of embrace of the socialist left, I think, is going to spell the end of the Democratic Party as we know it.
Well, what do you think about the No Kings rally? They say predominantly it was middle-aged white women that showed up on a Saturday. It sounds like the women's march when Trump got elected, which the day after, you remember Madonna made her famous statement, I kind of dream about blowing up the White House. So what is it? I didn't understand what middle-aged white women have against Trump.
Yeah. I mean, progressive ideology is mostly a white liberal college-educated ideology. It's a set of ideas that make people feel good about themselves without really understanding what the practical implications are of the ideas themselves. And it's true. It is a very popular amongst white college-educated women, and that's fine. It's also incredibly unpopular with the rest of the country. But the problem for the Democrats is the charisma, the energy, the fundraising is all on the progressive left side. And so that's who the party's playing to. The party's playing to a very, very small group of people that, again, have the energy, have the fundraising, but they are completely ignoring the rest of the country that does not want a cultural revolution on identity, that does not believe in wrecking the economy and destroying sort of the institutions of the West, which have done more to lift mankind out of poverty than any system ever in the history of the world. And this flirtation, this embrace of the sort of the jihadist left,
right,
that Mandami clearly represents, is something that is just offensive, I think, to 80-90% of Americans. So the party is going down a suicide march here.
Here's what Harold Ford said, former Democratic congressman, now valuable member of the Five. Cut 29.
And I listened to some interviews of his and some speeches, some other presentations he's given Mr. Mamdani. He sounds decisively mad and divisive, not uplifting, not unifying. I didn't hear any words. If you're about to become mayor or governor, an executive in a city or a state, nothing about safety, affordability, caring, pro-growth. All of us are going to do this together. This pitting of people against people is just unnecessary. It's not how you win a race, but not how you start a term to be the mayor of the most important city, the biggest city, the most vital city in all of the world, certainly the United States, and I would argue all of the world.
So, I mean, you got two mayors, one in San Jose and one in San Francisco, Democrats, that seem to get it, sound like Harold Ford and you, Julian Epstein. And they're still Democrats. They're not Republicans. They're not tempted to be Republicans, but they're trying to get crime down. They're trying to address the homelessness situation. They're trying to be smart with their money. And that's what Harold Ford pointed out. He brought up another city, too, Cut 30.
I will remind everybody, we have two mayors in this country. Just a year ago, people talked about these cities as being irretrievably perhaps too far to the left. And I'm a Democrat, not a socialist. Philadelphia elected a woman named Sherelle Parker, who decided to go after criminals, decided to ensure that we prosecuted those. And there's a guy out there in San Francisco named Daniel Lurie, who's decided he's going to work with President Trump on issues that really matter and impact the city. That's the direction my party's going in the future.
That's success leaves clues. Those are the clues I would hope for the country that Democrats would take. Do you find other people agree with you, Julian, or do you find yourself an outcast when you're with your Democratic friends?
I find myself a little bit of an outcast, but I also find that most people secretly agree that the center is where it's at. And that most people secretly agree that more cops for fighting crime, closed borders, a balanced energy policy, which is all of the above, minimum requirements on people that they work in order to receive welfare. These are all ideas that come out of the Clinton administration in the 90s. In fact, if you took a snapshot of Clinton's policies in the mid-90s and Trump's policies today, the Venn diagram would be very, very close. They would be very similar. They were similar on crime. They were similar on immigration. They were similar on energy. They were similar on welfare reform. They were similar on cultural moderation. And on economics, the whole idea of socialism that Mamdani offers is to give away a lot of free stuff to the downwardly mobile, mostly white podcast class, right? The idea that Clinton represented, and I think in the 90s, and I think Trump represents today, is that the answer to affordability, and by the way, affordability was made bad under the Biden administration because of 20% inflation during his administration. But the answer on affordability is learning how to build, using your agency to confront the economic challenges of the fourth phase of the Industrial Revolution and learning how to build your way out of the affordability problems. The answer of socialists and the increasingly progressive left is to just give up on the future, give up on building, to try to use other people's money to give away free stuff in order to expand what is a declining voter base on the left. And build up a bigger electorate because the working class is abandoning the party. And this is ultimately a plan that won't work politically, and it's a plan that'll kill you economically because, as Margaret Thatcher says, pretty soon you run out of other people's money. That's the problem with socialism. So to answer your question, I think a lot of people agree with what I just said, but they're too scared to say that because they fear the flying monkeys of the progressive online left.
Well, the other thing is you got two Democrats who say, yeah, I like what he does, but they won't endorse him. Governor Hochul says, yeah, I don't agree with any of his programs, but I'll endorse him. And then you have Mayor Pete. This guy could be a great mayor. You going to endorse him? No. Okay. He's actually a mayor. Could even though South Bend is a fraction of what New York City is, you might even be able to relate to him. Or do something. But no, I'm not going to do it. So they notice that he's getting some big crowds and he's got a smile. But when you hear, Bernie Sanders gets big crowds, AOC gets big crowds, I think people might have a misperception that it's going to lead to big election wins. We're about to find out if this is going to be your fracturing of a party, if they're going to have to break up. You know, what happened with the Tea Party with the Republicans, it really hurt them because the Tea Party candidates were winning the primaries, but they couldn't win the general. We'll see if that happens with the Democrats.
Yeah, well, big crowds don't really matter if you're turning off 80% of the voters. And that's the problem. They misinterpret the money, the excitement, the support that they get from the NGO and the activist socialist left as some type of endorsement for the idea of moving further left, when in fact the truth is exactly the opposite. The truth is that the party is offending two-thirds, three-quarters of the country through the cultural revolution of identity, through this increasingly moving left towards bigger government when the public wants smaller government. And again, this embrace of extremists, the sort of the violent rhetoric and the embrace of jihadist extremists, yeah. All of these things are intensely unpopular. And while they may have sort of a sugar high from what they think is some type of mandate that they're going to get from a mayoral election next week, where maybe 10-20% of voters will actually turn out. What they're in fact doing is they are creating a Procrustean bed for themselves, because they're going to be asked, as I say, every single Democrat throughout the country and up until the 2020 elections is going to say, do you agree with Mamdani on all of these things? And they're going to have to dance around those questions, because in most places, Mamdani's notion of some kind of economic and cultural revolution is incredibly unpopular. So the Democrats are just doing it to themselves once again. And we hoped they would learn the election of 2024. They haven't. They're moving in exactly the wrong direction, because they're getting pulled by the siren song of the progressive left that they don't realize is leading them off a cliff.
Go get them. Julian Epstein, thanks so much. Appreciate it. So we'll find out. We got an election 1 week from today. We'll see if the Democrats are supposed to win everything. I mean, they're supposed to win in Jersey. They're supposed to win in Virginia. They're going to lose the AG race. Jason Menares is doing great. And that's extremely problematic. Jason Jones is AG, you know, about his text messages. And Jack Cittarelli's got momentum in the endorsement of 13 Democratic mayors in the very blue New Jersey. You never know. Back in a moment.
It's Brian Kilmeade. He's so busy, he'll make your head spin. It's Brian Kilmeade.
11:50 in Los Angeles. Furman sends a fly ball to center field. Marshall's going back before the clock strikes me. Furman has ended it. It's a repeat hero with the last word and a Game 3 classic.
So there you are in the 18th inning. I mean, literally 2:30 in the morning. I get up at 2:30 in the morning. I'm in the car by 3 o'clock. That game was still going on. I never even thought to check it, but the Blue Jays in Game 3 lose in the 18th inning to the Los Angeles Dodgers at home. So the crowd went crazy. It's an historic time. It's tied for the second. It's tied for the longest game in history. The other one was Dodgers-Red Sox, so Dodgers involved in both. This guy, Ohtani, 4-for-4, including I think he had 2 or 3 walks, so in two homers and 2 doubles, while he's one of the best pitchers in baseball. I've never seen anything like it. It's almost like an after-school special where people talk about this guy that can play the field and he can pitch. What about he can play the field better than anybody else and hit better than anybody else and then pitch went better than anybody else? To me, that is insane. I don't know how you get that good at anything. So it's great for Fox, I think. I would love to see those ratings in the middle of the night, but now there's more intrigue to watch the next game. They also burned through so many pitchers. You're going to find out how much depth both sides have, and I do think the deepest team is the one that deserves it most. And the ones that could step up when there's a key injury, key defensive play, and we're going to see what happens from here. The Blue Jays, who took game one, lost game two. Heartbreaker in Game 3 when Freddie Freeman hit that homer, formerly of the Atlanta Braves. Very curious to see what happens from here on in. Also, baseball's smart. They backed out of Sunday. They gave Sunday to the NFL. So you have Monday, Tuesday. Monday Night Football's big, but it's not as big as it used to be. And then you got Tuesday, you own the night. And because no one's really caring much about hockey early or basketball early, you're not really caring that much about college basketball early, but you care about football, and there's no games on Tuesday. So really smart. So that's where we go from here. A couple other things. You have Cam Scatterboo. This guy's become a folk hero in New York, but around the country, people in California know him because he came from a small town in California. He went to Arizona State, and then he became this he's a little guy built out of muscle and who runs over people. He gets to New York, And he immediately starts making an impact. Whether the Giants win or lose, he's making an impact. To the point where he gets introduced to the Knick game. With all these stars there on opening night, he gets the biggest ovation. Even bigger than his quarterback. You know, bigger than Aaron Judge. And then he has the most horrific ankle injury you've ever seen. They literally dislocated it and was twisted around. They said he's lucky to get back by July. We'll see. A clean dislocation, which really freaked everybody out, to the point where the Philadelphia fans, known to be the people that booed Santa Claus, gave him a standing ovation. So that was classy. When we come back, Mayor Glenn Jacobs is going to be with us. He is AKA Hall of Fame professional wrestler Kane from Knox County, Tennessee. We're going to talk about what it takes to be a successful mayor. Do you have to be a socialist? We're about to find out.
Information you want, truth you demand. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Hey, we are back, everybody. With me in studio, great friend of the show, Mayor Glenn Jacobs. Made his name in wrestling, but now he's making his name in politics. He's Knox County, Tennessee, and Glenn, you would just tell me that even though Tennessee is not suffering from what Texas is. And that is, it's a red state that was so attractive that a lot of Democrats ruined their states and went there.
Yeah.
Well, you say it's not the case in Tennessee.
From what I've observed now, obviously, it's probably going to be different in different areas. For example, Nashville is a big city. You know, it's like the hip city now. So I do think that they get more Democrats moving there. They're also, you know, they're kind of our tech hub. But when you look at East Tennessee, I don't think that's the case. You know, the people that come into East Tennessee are conservatives who are tired of the foolishness in places like California and New York. And even Middle Tennessee, again, Nashville's in Middle Tennessee, but I've seen some polling come out of there that indicates the people moving there are Republicans, and they're actually more conservative in many cases than our native Tennesseans are, as crazy as that sounds.
I understand that the price in Nashville is so high, people don't even look there, right? So
yeah, and also, you know, Nashville's a great place, but it's become a very big city. Even before the pandemic, you saw this trend where people were moving to mid-sized cities, and I think the pandemic exacerbated that. So we do capture a lot in Knoxville, say Chattanooga, of folks that want to move to Tennessee, but they don't want to move to the big city. They want to move to a more laid-back quality of life.
So how do you think Trump's doing?
In Tennessee, yeah, phenomenal. As far as if you're referring to his polling in Tennessee, it is phenomenal.
So how do you think?
I think he's doing great. I don't think there's been a president that has been this effective as far as promoting his agenda and getting his agenda through ever, actually. And you look up and down the line at so many of the things he's been able to do. It's been very impressive thus far.
So I want you to hear somebody who disagrees with you.
Sure.
Vehemently. Cut 47. You want to put your headset?
Yeah. Thanks.
I can't sugarcoat any of this. These are dark days, but we're one of the only countries in the world that time and again has come out of every crisis we face stronger than we went into that crisis. Folks, it's time to get back up. It's time to get reengaged. It's time to act.
To fight like hell.
So how do you explain the different perception that he says we're in crisis, these are dark days, as opposed to somebody that would go, you know, I don't like this foreign policy, there's too many tariffs, Venezuela worries me, but instead, these are dark days. Have you met people like this? To me, I think these are the most intriguing days possible. You know, are there everything I love that Trump's doing? No.
Right.
But I love the work ethic. I love the agenda. I love the direction. I understand people don't agree. But how can you agree that much, disagree that much?
Well,
to dark days.
Well, you know, frankly, President Biden doesn't know what he's saying in many cases. And I think this is one of those. He might be thinking of the Carter years. But nevertheless, I agree with you. You know, none of us are going to agree with everybody on everything. But especially if you look where we had been the past 4 years, what could have happened if Kamala Harris had been president, those would have truly been dark days. I think the country is, for the most part, on the right path. You know, you're always going to have issues come up. That's just the case. You're always not going to agree with everything. But these are not dark days. In fact, I would say this is the light of the tunnel after 4 years of darkness.
I'm going to bring you to another Democrat. Kamala Harris herself was asked at the BBC because there's a huge problem with KJP's book, the press secretary, who said she never noticed anything. He was always on his game. I don't know what you're talking about. She's mad at Democrats, right?
Yeah.
So here, so she's mad at Democrats for throwing out Biden. She still can't understand it. And then there's Kamala Harris, who keeps telling us he was fine, but I was a better candidate. So she gets these questions on both of their book tours. Cut 49.
What I spoke of in the book is that there is a very serious difference between capacity to be president of the United States and the capacity to run for president of the United States. And so it is on that latter piece that I talk about in the book, about my concern about his ability with the level of endurance, energy that it requires, especially running against now the current president.
So let me get this straight. The president of the United States doesn't have to have energy and endurance. You only need that when you're running for office.
That's her explanation that she wrote in the book. That means an editor had to sign off on it.
You know, I mean, look, the poor guy is shaking hands with thin air. He's being led around by the Easter Bunny. Normally, we would either feel sorry for him or we would laugh at him. He's the leader of the free world. There was a real issue. The biggest cover-up in American history was the fact that it was obvious that the president of the United States was in serious mental decline and no one in his administration was doing anything about it, much less admitting to the problem.
And we're all susceptible because of this. And I'm the last thing I'll do, because we're going to talk about much more than this. Jonathan Karl has a book out about what went down from his perspective on how the Democratic ticket fell apart and then how Donald Trump reemerged. Here's what he said happened as it became clear that Biden couldn't run anymore between Obama and Pelosi. Here's what he said this morning. Cut 45.
Joe Biden announces he gets out of the race. Nancy Pelosi gets out in front and supports Kamala Harris. And you report that Barack Obama called her basically asking, what the F did you just do?
Yeah, the two of them had been basically working to try to get Biden out of the race. And they had been adamant that when he gets out, we need to have some kind of a process, whether it be a mini flash primary, something, a meeting of delegates, something.
And don't just hand it over to Kamala.
Don't just hand it over to Kamala Harris. Right. And they had a pact on this. Yeah. And she gets out and everybody endorses her within hours, you know, Shapiro, Whitmer, Gavin Newsom, that they're all endorsing her within hours. Pelosi actually waits till the next day, but she sees that there's nothing to hold the tide. So she puts out the endorsement, gets this phone call. I actually spoke to somebody who overheard the phone call. And what Obama says is basically, what, Nancy, what was that all about? And clearly irritated. Now, I've spoken to people close to President Obama who say he was just kind of giving her, joshing with her and giving her a hard time. I've spoken to another person who, very close to Pelosi, says, no, she was pissed off. She was angry. He was angry. The clear message was, why did you do that?
Have you ever seen such chaos behind the scenes?
I know, right? No. Part of the reason that people got so disillusioned with the Democrat Party in this past election cycle was because they're out front talking about threats to democracy, and then they anoint someone to be their nominee who never even won any primaries or anything like that. You know, for all of his policy faults, President Obama is a pretty shrewd politician. And I think that he understood that was going to come back and bite him. And it did. It just turned people off. And she was a terrible candidate, by the way. And instead of having some sort of process, it was just, oh, this is our person. And again, they're the ones out there running around talking about how Donald Trump is a threat to democracy. And then they completely undermine the democratic process themselves.
So how are the tariffs affecting you guys in Tennessee?
I haven't really noticed a whole lot.
Do you have a rural community?
We have a mixed community. Obviously, it's going to increase input prices on some things. I believe that President Trump uses these more as a negotiating tool.
Yeah.
You know, and you can see that by implementing them, taking them off, doing all the different things he's going to do. So I think at the end of the day, this is going to be something that we have to look back on and see the impact, as opposed to say, you know, what are the ongoing impacts, because they're just shifting all the time.
I know everyone's watching. I mean, you have people in Iowa watching closely what's happening in the Far East because they want to find out about soybeans and their crops because China just stopped buying it.
Right.
Do you have any export that is susceptible to these tariffs or trade?
It, again, for us, it's going to be the input prices. say, with raw materials. And we do have manufacturing, those sort of things. And that's probably what concerns me more than the export prices, is raising the prices of raw goods, making our manufacturers less competitive.
So when you look right now at what's happening in Tennessee, Marsha Blackburn is going to make a move. She decided enough of Washington, Congress, Senate. She won at least twice, mm-hmm. and now she's going to run for governor. What role will you play in a run for governor?
I'm her treasurer, so I'm helping her out a lot of times.
Does she have enough money?
Yeah. She'll be fine, and her, you know, her name ID around the state is very high. She has a great political organization, and she's a great campaigner. She's tireless. Now, one thing is, obviously, with her Senate schedule, she can't be everywhere all the time, so people like me are helping out with that. But she is going to be the next governor of the great state of Tennessee. I'm sure of that.
And then when you're done with your term?
I am out September of next year.
September of next year.
Yes, sir.
Would you be open to that Senate seat? Should she get to win the governor? And she's supposed to win.
Yeah, it's way too early for that. You know, I still have almost a year in office. That's what I'm concentrating on. I don't know what my political future looks like, if there is one. Right now, I just want to make sure that she becomes the next governor, and then we'll go from there.
Do you like it enough to want to keep doing it? Because for you, you told me it's service.
Yeah, it is service. I don't know if I necessarily like it. I feel the reward of being able to do hopefully constructive things in our community. At the same time, you know, I'm actually an introvert, so a lot of these things are kind of, you know, they take a lot of energy from me to do. And I'm also, as weird as this sounds, I'm not a very confrontational person either. I have to really, you know, I have to get out there and do those things. But in the end, yes, the service, especially where our country is, and, you know, you look at what's happening here in the New York City mayoral race and some of these other things, you know, good people have to step up. Because if they don't, I think that our country is really at a tipping point. And if the good people don't step up, I don't know what the future of our country looks like.
So we have the Mayor Mondami. It looks like he's going to win. He's up by 10, but who knows about closing that rapidly. He had a 20-point lead, so it is going down. I think his candidacy is alarming a lot of people who think that, how do we run against this while not calling him out?
Right.
Mayor Pete comes out and goes, I like what he's doing, but he won't endorse him. Senator Schumer still has not endorsed him. So when you talk to Democrats, how many people feel like Bernie Sanders, AOC, and Mondami, as opposed to the Manchins and the Fettermans?
In Tennessee, it's going to be more moderates, especially in our part of the country. You know, you get over into Nashville, we have a special election for Congress there. Representative Mark Green, Congressman Mark Green, he resigned. So in December, there'll be a special election. The Republican candidate is Matt Van Epps. The Democrat is a state rep who fashions herself the AOC of Tennessee. So, you know, who knows? But I think what happens is, I think the Democrat Party, especially in areas of the country, is much more left than their constituents. But I think that many of the politicians, the Democrat politicians, are so afraid of literally offending or alienating a very small percentage of their own base, which we see with someone like Mondami. You know, what they're doing is, oh, we don't want to tick these people off. At the same time, we know these policies are going to be disastrous, so we want to play thread that needle of not being too close to him, so when everything falls apart, we can keep it arm's length, but we also don't want to offend a very vocal part of their base.
Because they're young.
Yeah.
Right? And
yeah, the young,
you know,
people.
The same people, the turning point is turned around.
Right.
That's who he
and,
excited.
And, you know, and when we see this in Tennessee, it's also a lot of old people that are just, you know, I don't quite understand, but it's a lot of older folks. I shouldn't say old people, just older folks who, you know, it's almost like they're throwbacks to the 1960s, if that makes sense.
So the one thing is, the political correctness has gone out the window. The DEI is no longer in fashion.
Yeah.
And also, we're ready to celebrate our country's history.
250 years coming up.
What are you guys doing in Tennessee?
The state's already put things in motion. Starting here in a few weeks, we will probably start looking at things to do in Knox County. You know, we're very proud of our history. This is the greatest nation on the planet. The reason is because we celebrate the individual. We celebrate freedom, liberty. We are the beacon to the rest of the world. And that is something absolutely that we should celebrate. We should hold high and hold our heads high.
Mayor Glenn Jacobs, our guest. And Mayor, are you amazed at the party that was taking down statues, embarrassed about our history, took Teddy Roosevelt out of the Museum of Natural History? You know, they tried to take Columbus down wherever they can. It got the video of every Confederate soldier. It's been destroyed and sidelined somewhere. They're concerned about the history of the White House as they just try to improve it. Can you have both concepts exist in your world?
There's a lot of cognitive dissonance going on right now. And you look at the White House, and it's, you know, I believe that's being privately funded as well.
Totally.
Right? Yeah, so it's like, okay, great. You know, you're doing an upgrade. I mean, we do it in our city hall. Well, we've done that as well. No, it's just something to be mad about. I wonder at what point does outrage fatigue set in? You know, people can't always be mad about everything all the time. But, you know, with Donald Trump, it's like, it's raining today. It must be Donald Trump's fault. It's hot today. It must be Donald Trump's fault. We've gotten to that point.
See if you agree with me on this. I remember succinctly that Ronald Reagan was mocked constantly. This guy doesn't do anything.
Right,
everyone else runs the department. He's out of it. And all of a sudden, after he passed away, sadly, after the years of Alzheimer's, people come out of the woodwork and say, greatest president ever. And Democrats go, yeah, let's name the airport after him. And let's do this. And I'm thinking to myself, wait a second. I remember being in high school and you guys mocking him to death. Mm-hmm. And he's ruining the country and he's going to get us into a nuclear war. Do you think the same thing's going to happen to Trump? Where people are going to... You think they're always going to have this negative?
Yes. Even with Reagan, you had like Tip O'Neill, you know, and obviously, you know, Reagan and O'Neill disagreed, but they were also able to work together on things. I think there was mutual respect between those two. That's just all gone now. There's just nothing. And I mean, look, they tried to shoot the guy. Okay. I mean, that's fact of the matter. So I don't think that at the end of the day that any of us, even years from now, are going to be sitting around a campfire singing Kumbaya about Donald Trump, which is unfortunate because, again, I think he's been very effective, especially in the second term.
I want to have you back 5 years after he's gone. And I bet you
see if we're right.
And I think that his approval rating will be in the 60s.
Yeah.
Because, you know, look at Bud George W. Bush. He left in the 20s, and he's now at 59%.
But the reason that will happen is because the Democrat policies will fail. And there will be more Republicans.
There you go.
Not going to be because the current Democrats think
this?
He's the greatest.
Are you
thing
taping
ever.
This? Okay, because I don't want this to be our first argument. Mayor Jacobs.
And I hope that's the case, Brian.
All right, thanks so much. And you're using wrestling, of course, with Kane. You're a Hall of Famer. And now you're doing your best for Knox County, Tennessee. Mayor, thanks so much.
Thanks, Brian.
Illuminating, intriguing, inculcating.
I know some of these words.
It's Brian Kilmeade. From his mouth to your ears, it's Brian Kilmeade. Sponsored by Prevagen. Prevagen, made for your brain.
It's going to be interesting on election night because you're going to have two gov races where Democrats are likely going to win statewide. Later in the night, you're going to have a ballot measure which will pass convincingly in California, which is a big win for Gavin Newsom. It's going to be fascinating to see how much the right keeps the focus on New York City.
They're going to try to, but it's going to be very hard when you have the governor of Virginia right across the Potomac.
From D.C.,
If she wins, you got a centrist Democrat winning there. You got a centrist Democrat across from the number one media market in the world.
Hudson,
If Mikey Sherrill ends up winning. So you've got those two. You've got the California ballot measure that, again, the Trump White House has, like, drawn even more focus to by the stupid Justice Department thing they're talking about doing to try to spook voters when, as Jay Martin said, just going to inspire them. So, yeah, Democrats going to be saying, yeah, you know, we're a diverse party, unlike you guys. You just do what Donald Trump says. We just elected two moderates and a socialist.
I don't look at those other two. Mikey Sherrill, I just look as incompetent. What is she moderate on? She's going to freeze rents? That's what the communist is going to do. What is? Did you see Abigail Spanberger? She just sat there, just not answering questions about girls and men and women's girls in bathrooms and all these things, and talk about law enforcement. Is she going to enforce crime? She hasn't talked about that. Mikey Sherrill going to do that? She going to lower taxes? Please tell me how. I've never heard her say she's going to lower taxes or have a plan to do so. So I don't look at them as two moderates. If Democrats win, Democrats win. But they were both wins they're supposed to have. And Proposition 50, they put $40 million into it. So they're trying to squeeze those seven Republicans out of their seats in California. We'll see how that goes because Indiana's now doing that.